Flight 6. Calling Flight 6. This is WSB calling Flight 6. Switch over to Martin's Creek. Beam. Keep altitude 5,000.
You. Calling BQ. Calling BQ. This is station.
Hello, London. New York calling. We are ready to
switch around. Storm warning. Storm warning. To all ships in the vicinity of Cape Hatteras. To all ships in the vicinity of Cape Hatteras.
Calling car 621. Calling car 621. A robbery has been committed at shoe store on Main near Center. Robbery.
Ripping the night air with the speed of light, at this moment, while you listen to one voice, the electric wings of radio speed from 10,000 high steel towers, carrying the thoughts, music, and communications of man.
36 years ago, on a Thursday in 1901, while the harsh bite of a December wind cut around a small board shack in Newfoundland, the three dots you are hearing now, representing the letter S in Morse code, sped over the turbulent Atlantic.
The target, in all the world of space, was a thin wire tossing from the end of a kite 3,000 miles away.
And the ears of a young Italian, poised for the electric sound, as a bird for flight.
He heard that sound, and the wall of time cracked. Calling all cars. Calling all cars.
Hello, Australia. Hello, Australia. New York calling. Hello.
Storm warning. Storm warning. Clouds low over Rock Height 6. Altitude 5,000.
Thirty-six years ago, this week, on a Thursday in December 1901, one man in all the world listened.
Tonight, deep in some primitive jungle, far in some snowbound wasteland, in Shanghai, Cape Town, and Medicine Hat, 500 million people are listening.
At this second, as one wave channel speaks these words to you, somewhere on a tiny tramp steamer in the South Seas, a man listens to the staccato buzz, which is his bridge to the outside world.
The nightbound transport, the comforting hum of beam radio is guiding an aviator down the electric roadway to the Tanbark at Croydon.
The landing apron at Newark, the airport at Burbank. As these words come to you, somewhere radio has apprehended a criminal, brought warning of angry elements, comforted the isolated.
This all because 36 years ago, a young man dreamed a dream and saw it crystallize into fantastic reality.
Tonight, on the anniversary of this epical event, the Columbia Workshop is proud to pay homage to the father of radio, Guglielmo Marconi, by presenting a dramatization of R.E. Dunlap Jr.'s book, Marconi, the Man and His Wireless.
Years after Christopher Columbus charted unknown seas and found the new world of land, another young Italian dreamed of an unconquered world of space. The year 1895, the Villa Grifoni in Pontecchio, Italy.
Oh, come, come, Guglielmo. Enough of this nonsense. I have many things to attend to.
Oh, Father, don't be so impatient with him.
I shall have it ready in just one second.
If you clutter this house up with more wires and machinery, we will have to move out to the stables.
Don't mind him, son.
There. Now watch, Father. I press this switch. So. You hear?
The bell, yes. So.
But there are no wires between the switch and the bell, Father. The bell is two floors removed, and I've made it ring.
Guglielmo.
How is it done?
Persian waves. They were discovered by a German Jew named Heinrich Hertz. He's a professor at Kiel. I've been studying his work at school. Now that I'm finished, I want to continue experimenting where he left off.
Guglielmo, what use can it be? I grant you it's strange, fantastic, this ringing a bell without using wires, but let us be realistic. Wire can be used. All you have accomplished is to save the cost of a few feet of cheap wire.
Always realistic. Oh, leave him be. The work excites and amuses him, and that is enough.
But, Mother, you don't understand. Can't you see? If these waves are powerful enough to cut through floors, they may reach across a town, a country, a continent. Why, it sounds incredible, I know. But someday we may be able to send them across ocean.
Guillermo, I like your spirit and enthusiasm. It's a fine thing for a young man to have, but one must control oneself. Suppose what you say is true. Suppose I grant you that these waves will cut across oceans. Why would anyone want to ring a bell in, say, America?
Well done. What is your answer to that?
If these waves can carry the impulse to ring a bell, why can't the bell spell out words? Messages. Imagine, through the air, faster than the swiftest bird can fly.
Why, you're right, Father. It's so simple it hasn't occurred.
Of course. Think. No cables, no obstacles. And people communicating over thousands of miles.
Well, suppose...
I think it's a great ambition, Guglielmo. Work on it, son. Work hard.
But surely some scientist would have thought of utilizing these waves if it were possible. Someone would have learned if these waves can carry more than a few feet to ring a bell.
I have thought of that, Father. And I must admit you seem right. There are men of much greater training and ability in physics. Faraday, Hertz, Maxwell, who must have tried... But there is still a chance that I may succeed.
Well, of course, but it may be an idle dream. You may waste important years only to fail. Well, I beg you had a chance to study such things in college, but now you must be more serious. You must start setting the foundation for your career.
But this is my career.
Yes, Father, you must let him.
Well, you can toy around with it and still shape a more serious career. I want you to study music, Guillermo. There is something for you. That its roots and traditions in our soil. Verdi, Prestigi, Donizetti, Carlini. There you have men of whom the world has heard. They left something.
No, I am determined to go on, Father. This work will require all my time. The world has heard of Hertz and Faraday and Maxwell. Maybe someday they'll hear of Marconi.
Constantly encouraged by his Scotch mother, the 22-year-old Italian boy pursued his dream, sent the magic Hertzian waves from one end of the house to the other, and then from the house to the lawn, and soon convinced his doubting father of its great possibility.
Signor Marconi contributed $1,000, and in the spring of 1895, the boy inventor started to test wireless in open space. Greater and greater were the distances spanned, until the signal had covered the unbelievable length of 1 mile. In some weeks after the first test, our young Marconi worked.
What are you planning to do today, Guillermo?
I'm going to try to send a signal to Alfonso.
But you did that yesterday.
Oh, but yesterday I could see Alfonso. And he waved a flag when he heard my signal. Today he's beyond it.
Why there?
Because only one great obstacle still remains. I do not know whether these waves will cut through all objects. The hill is more than 3/4 of a mile wide at the base. If it has penetrated in this test, very few barriers remain.
No, but how will you know if he hears you?
Alfonso has a shotgun. If he hears the signal, he will find it.
You really think it's me, Costello?
We shall see, Father. We shall see. I think you'd better stand a bit further back from the star coil. I'm using more power today.
Oh, all right, we hear more.
Thank you, Father. And now we try.
Well...
Perhaps Alfonso wasn't ready. I'll try it again. He's heard it, Father.
Oh.
He heard it.
The gunshot from behind the hill became the first salute to wireless. But Marconi's dream was only half accomplished. And for 4 more years, he worked tirelessly, simplifying apparatus, improving technique, increasing power and distance, until in 1899, Europe was startled to hear that a wireless message had been sent across the English Channel, a distance of 24 miles.
And then, in the heart of the young Italian, a new dream burned.
That dream was to conquer the Atlantic. In July 1900, Marconi and his two assistants, Kemp and Paget, went to the barren southwest tip of England and selected Paulsview as the site of that transmitter.
It was to be 100 times more powerful than any yet built.
Higher and higher, the mast lifted against the sky.
Then, by the end of August, 1 year later, when the masts were almost completed, a gale swept the English coast and destroyed the entire work.
lesser men than this young Italian dreamer might not have met that scene of destruction with the calm that he did on that turbulent, windswept day in 1901.
Well, that's the end of a year's labor, Kent.
Oh, we've had setbacks before, Mr. Marconi. We'd have to rebuild.
No, there's no time. Conditions aren't suitable. It would take 6 months to repair the damage, and we would run the same risk every day. We can't wait.
Perhaps another site.
No. We'll have Vivian set up temporary equipment here. The signal won't be as strong as we hoped for, but it should be strong enough. You and Paget will come with me.
Where?
To America.
America?
Of course. Why does that surprise you?
Well, now, we have no equipment, Mr. Marconi. We can't carry masts and gear all the way. How will we get our aerial wire sufficiently high to get the signal?
We'll take balloons, kites, anything that might work. We'll get that aerial up high enough somehow.
Undramatically, unnoted, the trio of pioneers landed at St. John's, Newfoundland on Friday, December the 6th, 1901. But let Marconi's own words describe the events of a week which reshaped the destiny of mankind. On Monday, December 9th, we began work. On Tuesday, we flew a kite with 600 feet of aerial as a preliminary test. And on Wednesday, we inflated one of the balloons, which made its first ascent during the morning. After a short while, however, the blustery wind ripped the balloon away from the wire. The balloon sailed out over the sea. We concluded perhaps the kite would be better. And on Thursday morning, in spite of a gusty gale, we managed to fly a kite up 400 feet. The critical moment had come, for which the way had been prepared by 6 years of hard and unremitting work. Despite the usual criticism directed at anything new, I was about to test the truth of my belief. Before leaving England, I had given detailed instructions for transmission of a certain signal, the Morse telegraphic S, 3 dots at a fixed time each day, beginning as soon as word was received that everything at St. John's was in readiness. If the invention could receive on the kite wire in Newfoundland some of the electric waves produced, I knew the solution of the problem of transoceanic wireless telegraphy was at hand.
As the hands of the clock moved toward the appointed hour on that Thursday in December 1901, Marconi sat tightly pressing a telephone receiver to his ear, while his two assistants watched with tense expectancy.
Beyond rolled the unbroken ocean, nearly 2,000 miles to the coast of the British Isles.
Wireless might leap that in 1/93rd of a second.
Yet no one had taken enough interest in the experiment to climb through the snow to Signal Hill.
1/2 hour passed.
I received my cable at Koldo. They've been sending for the past 30 minutes. We haven't heard a sound.
We checked the instruments 1,000 times.
Is the kite still up high?
Yes. I just looked out of the window. But a million other things might be wrong. Some electrical force might have led the signals astray. Perhaps they were right in England. The curvature of the earth may be a barrier.
Patience, Paget. They may not be ready in England. They may be having trouble with the transmitter.
The world must think us fools, expecting a signal for all these miles of space with nothing but air in between.
Quiet, gentlemen. We must listen carefully. We're only guessing the waves. Our tuning is crude. We cannot expect the test in 1/2 hour.
Suppose it doesn't come through.
We'll calibrate our measurements better. We'll remodel our equipment. We'll try again, sooner or later.
Can the whole thing be too fantastic to work?
Quiet. I think I heard something.
What did you hear?
Please, please, quiet.
Imagine. Do you hear anything?
Come here, Kent. Put the receiver to your ear. Listen carefully.
What I imagine. Wait.
It's England. We've got them, no doubt about it. You've done it, Mr. Marconi. You've done it.
The
Thus, in the first year of a new century, the dawn of a new electrical age was heralded by the three tiny dots that spread across the Atlantic.
In less than 8 years, 180 of the world's vessels were equipped with Marconi wireless. But to the world at large, it was still untried by tragedy, unproved by catastrophe, until...
January 23rd,
1909. Wallowing through the thick fog off Sandy Hook, the SS Republic noses out to sea, bound east for the Mediterranean. Westbound for New York, the SS Florida steams at half speed. Foghorn bleating as the lookouts in bow and crow's nest peer into the fog with burning eyes, seeking the first glimpse of the Ambrose lightship. Night and fog. The throbbing of great turbines. The slow, greasy wash of the sea. And two great ships blindly groping in the dark.
Filthy night, quartermaster.
Aye, sir, it is.
Be out of it by tomorrow sundown, though. Weather's always clearer in southern waters.
Aye, sir.
Don't like fog, quartermaster. Rather be in a typhoon any day to a North Atlantic fog. Who wouldn't, though?
Oh, I don't mind it, sir. Something nice about fog. Quiet. Peaceful. I always thought death would be something like this, sir. Peace and a heavy fog.
Death was like this and they threw in that fog horn, it'd be hell.
Aye, sir, it would, but then even the sound of a fog horn looking at it one way ain't so bad. Sort of like a lullaby it is.
So it could just unnatural, that's all.
Well, for instance, sir, take that fog horn right now. Sounds almost human. And listen, the fog's so thick it seems to be answering itself. Holding a conversation with itself.
Wait a minute, quartermaster. That isn't a fog echo we're hearing.
Well, what else?
Quiet.
Oh, I've heard it many times in the fog.
Maybe so. But I don't like the sound of it. Look alive.
Aye, sir.
That's no echo we're hearing. That's another ship.
It does seem to be getting closer.
What direction is it coming from?
Well, I can't tell, sir. The sound is deceptive in the fog.
Quiet. I can't tell either.
The sea plays strange tricks on
us. Look alive. There's a ship bearing down on us. Hard aport.
Hard aport, sir.
Full speed ahead.
Full speed ahead, sir. We can't make it, sir. She's going to crash.
Hard aport, you fool. Hard aport.
It's no good, sir. We're going to crash.
We've been talking midship, sir. Order all bulkhead closed.
Yes, sir.
Order all passengers up in the first-class saloon in their life belts.
Yes, sir.
On your way below, sir. See if Mr. Biddle's wireless equipment is ready. Tell him to send for help. If we ever needed that newfangled contraption, they're going to need it this morning.
Aye, aye, sir.
Mr. Benn!
Yes, sir.
Mr. Benn, is your apparatus working?
It's pretty well smashed. Collision hit just south of the shack, as you can see, sir.
You think you can get a message through?
Power's off, but I can try my emergency batteries.
Very well, do so at once. Send out the assistance call.
Yes, sir. I just have to change this lead from the battery to the coil. There. Now we'll see if we can raise fire sconces. There you are, sir. See that nice fast spark? We're getting out all right.
Good. Tell them we've been rammed.
Yes, sir.
Give them our position and ask.
Dawn had many ears that morning. Not only fog-bound Nantucket heard that cry for help.
The Baltic, inbound, 115 miles east of Sandy Hook, heard it and leaped forward to the gray swells.
The French liner La Lorraine turned from a course and swung out to sea.
The Cunarder, Lucania.
The revenue cutters, Mohawk and Seneca.
All heard the faint cry for help sputtering through the dawn. All answered.
The world knew little of spark coils and coherers and hertzian waves on that cold January morning in 1909. But the world could understand this fact, that because of these strange things with queer names, because of this magic, the lives of more than 1,500 people had been saved.
other wonders to come. Less than 10 years after Marconi hurled the first thin signal across the Atlantic, just a year after Wireless had saved 1,000-odd passengers of the Republic in Florida, the first operatic broadcast in the history of radio occurred in New York, when on January 20th, 1910, microphones were placed on the stage of the Metropolitan Opera House, and the great Enrico Caruso's performance of Cavalleria Rusticana was broadcast to an audience of 50 listeners grouped about a handful of wireless receivers in New York and Brooklyn. Dr. Lee DeForest, whose experiments with audio tubes had made this broadcast possible, makes a fantastic prediction.
Someday, vessels departing from New York will have Pagliacci, Cavalleria Rusticana, and other operatic masterpieces every evening halfway across the ocean, and then they will be entertained by concerts from London, Paris, or Berlin, the other half.
Predictions in 1910. But 2 years later, when the sinking of the Titanic focused the world's attention on the immeasurable value of wireless, they realized that a new and indispensable factor had come into their lives. Less than 10 years later, everyone was scratching Galena crystals and adjusting earphones to listen to the programs of KDKA and other experimental broadcasting stations. And by 1922, the man who had started it all was so intrigued with the report of American pioneering in this new field that he visited New York in his floating laboratory, the famed steam yacht, Electra.
On a bright morning in June 1922, the golden white Electra, the largest Italian yacht ever to cross the Atlantic, slowly steamed up the bay and into the Hudson River amid the raucous cacophony of a New York harbor welcome. The anchor had scarcely splashed off the foot of 86th Street when the gentlemen of the press clambered over the side.
Hold it, Mr. Marconi. Thank you. One more shot, Mr. Marconi, please. Thanks.
Well, Mr. Marconi, how's New York look to you to this press?
That's rather a difficult question, since I haven't been ashore yet.
Yeah, I guess it is.
But I believe I can answer it. At least, partially. The wireless tells me that New York is a lively place, for I have been listening to your broadcasts for the last 300 miles at sea.
Yeah? Oh, I didn't know the radio went so far. Well, Miss Marconi, what do you think about it?
The development of the radio broadcasting and the widespread public interest in radio here seems to indicate that the United States is far ahead of Europe.
Do you think we'll ever be able to talk on the telephone across the ocean, Mr. Marconi?
Yes, that is quite near. Much nearer than some people think.
I don't know as I'd like having the world listening to my conversation.
Well, I cannot promise that the conversation will be absolutely secret between speaker and listener. But it is my conviction that the human voice will soon cross the sea.
What about the future of radio, Mr. Marconi?
Today, we communicate readily by wireless, and we haven't begun to explore the possibilities of the vacuum tube and shortwave. I think it not incredible that in the near future, even lantern slides may be projected by radio.
But even the vision of Marconi the dreamer could not anticipate in 1922 what his life work has since accomplished. For today,
we interrupt the program regularly scheduled at this time to bring you the abdication speech of the King of England.
At long last, I can say a few words.
Come on, a snapback. Perfect up. Back for the pass. No, no, he changed his mind. He swings around left end. 5 yards. 10.
Warning to all ranchers in the San Fernando Valley. Frost expected.
broadcasting from a point about 100 yards from the front line. Over the sound of my voice, you may have heard isolated traffic.
Such is the prodigious child of the humble letter S, Guglielmo Marconi, sent across the garden, through the hills, and 36 years ago this week, across the Atlantic.
Marconi, tireless in his investigation, always asked himself, what next? And then found the answer. The modern world, Marconi's world, a radio-minded world, has learned, too, to ask, what next? Expects an answer. What next? The sound you're hearing now is a television transmitter. Each second that you listen, 24 pictures are sent flying through the air. You'll be moving images on television screens. Someday soon, just as now voice reaches you wherever you are, the events of the world will move before your eyes. That is next.
Marconi envisioned the projection of pictures by wireless. He lived to see television an actuality. Then, on a July day last summer, death claimed him, and he left the world a much different place than he had found it. When 1,000 years from now, the kings and presidents, statesmen and warriors have been forgotten with the past, the name of Marconi will be remembered as Pythagoras, Newton, and Pasteur.
2,000 years before Marconi was born, the ancient Greeks, who started man's search into the mysterious properties of electricity when they rubbed amber against their sleeves, believed that no state could be successful unless all its citizens could gather within the sound of one voice. From the lips of the man who made such a thing possible came these words in one of the last former broadcasts he made.
The great need of the present day is for a better understanding between men and nations. And this understanding can be fostered and helped by improvements in our communications. The most direct and satisfying means of communication between man is the spoken word. In this respect, broadcast telephony occupies a unique position as being the most potent means for the instantaneous, universal dissemination of information, instruction, and entertainment the world has ever known. I am happy if by any efforts of mine, I have been able to make some contribution to this international sympathy and understanding.
Columbia Workshop has presented a dramatization of Orrin E. Dunlap Jr.'s book, Marconi, the Man and His Wireless, in celebration of the 36th anniversary of the spanning of the Atlantic by wireless. William N. Robeson and Irving Reese dramatized the story for radio and directed. Next week, the Columbia Workshop will present an original radio play on the life of one of America's greatest jurists, Oliver Wendell Holmes. The play, Mr. Justice, was written especially for the workshop by Max Lerner, editor of The Nation. Tune in next Thursday at this same time for Mr. Justice. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.